This is side one of the second tape of the August 8th, 1986 interview with Albert Gufford of Mayport, Florida. The interviewer is David Taylor.
I was wondering, now we've gone up towards the present and back and been around the market a bit. I was wondering what Mayport looked like when you first came here.
When I first came here, Mayport was a good-sized little town. We had houses all the way along this, what we call Ocean Street then. It was a Mayport Road back in those days. It had a pogey plant which made fertilizer down below here, right on the curve, the other side of the Coast Guard station. That was houses all the way down there. They had their own quarters down there. And there was two-story houses all along this Ocean Street here. All the way down here there was houses, and back, that was before the Naval Station was here. And that was all solid houses back in there. A lady by the name of Mrs. Stark, she wasn't a Stark when she moved here. I can't remember now what her name was, what her maiden name was. But she came down from Baltimore with a driver. You would call a chauffeur in an automobile today, but a horse, two horses, and carriage came down from Baltimore. She had been down here previously and bought all this property where the Naval Station is now. She owned most all of that, had some elaborate houses out there. In fact, the old administration building, they have preserved it, was her home. She later married this coach driver of hers. His name was Stark.
Oh, yeah.
He later married her, and she sold that property to the Navy, and I don't know what she got out of it, but it must have been a good, tidy sum. Hmm. So then she moved out to Wonderwood, which is a part of East Mayport. We used to call it all East Mayport, but now it's called Wonderwood. She bought some more property out there on a little lake, and she got sick. Mr. Stark, in fact, he got sick. Mr. Stark died first. He had sugar diabetes, his legs taken off, and he finally died. But he was a very wonderful man. He believed in the young people and helped us anywhere in the world he could in sports. Well, if we wanted to go somewhere and we didn't have transportation, he would take his automobile and take us. He was a very, very good man. Mrs. Stark continued to live after Mr. Stark had died. But her money went. Where her money went, nobody really ever knows. And she started selling her property off. And when she died, they almost buried her in a pauper's grave. She was so broke. But they finally, I think some of her relatives from Baltimore came down here, saw that she was put away nice. There's never a grave marker put on her. The Girl Scouts in this area, in the Beaches area, and, well, most of those Girl Scouts, she was a troop leader of Girl Scouts back in those days. They all fought a lot of the young people and tried to do things for the young people. And the Girl Scouts and former Girl Scouts got together here a few years back and sold cookies and candy and raised enough money to put a headstone on her grave.
Oh, nice.
She's buried out here in the Mayport Cemetery.
Oh, yeah. Now, weren't you telling me something about the Girl Scouts during the war and something about a beach patrol? Were you telling me about that?
No.
Was there something like that? They were.
The only beach patrol we had back in those days, back in World War II, we had the Army was stationed out here at Seminole Beach, and they had I don't know what size their guns were. You could never see them. They were all camouflaged. But we had about, I guess it's 100 men stationed out here. And now there was guns all camouflaged. And they had them aimed at the channel out here. If an enemy sub or anything started coming in the channel, it was well defended. Then down South Ponte Vedra, they had a big old building down there that they called the Coast Guard Station. The Coast Guard went down there and manned that, and they had a horse patrol on the beach. They rode the beaches day and night with horses to patrol the beaches. And they, in fact, they were patrolling the beaches when those German spies came off of that submarine and landed there at Ponte Vedra, right at the south end of Ponte Vedra itself, mm-hmm. not at South Ponte Vedra. Mm-hmm. So South Ponte Vedra is quite a few miles down the road from there. But as far as I know, that's all the patrols we ever had.
Oh, yeah. Now, getting back to this community again, what were some of the prominent families who were living here at that time?
The Gavigans were the most prominent, I would say, at that time. He was just of the peace. Mm-hmm. Had a big grocery store right on the corner where this little market
is.
Yeah, right on that corner right there. And the Daniels, they were very prominent people. They were, all the men folks were always pilots, bar pilots. We had the Tarbles, which he was a bar pilot. We had the Singletons, Captain Sam Singleton. He was the boatman for the Pilots Association. They had a big schooner called the Mita that they lived aboard. It was anchored out in Rebalt Bay, which is a naval station now.
It's called the Meter?
Mita.
M-E-T-E-R?
M-E-T-E-R. I believe it was M-E-T-E-R, yeah. But it's been so darn many years that I don't really remember the exact spelling of it.
Yeah.
Captain Singleton, Sam Singleton, he was the captain of this schooner. And he used to sail out to put a pilot on a ship, or to, with an outgoing ship, sail out there and go alongside of the ship and take the pilot off with a sailing vessel. Mm-hmm. Oh, he was quite a character. But the Singletons and the Gavigans, and there was a couple of families of Floyds. We have about, I think there's about four families of Floyds originally here, and none of them were related. Mm-hmm. They came from different places here, and how that many Floyds wound up in a little small village like this, I'll never know. But that's the way it was, and we've still got a lot of, well, I think we've got only about two families of Floyds left now. The other all died out or moved away.
In addition to the Pogie plant, what were the names of some of the other the fish houses that were here at that time?
Manuel Jesus had a fish house here. Johnson had a fish house here. Ike Lewis had a fish house here. There's one other I'm trying to remember. Tom, don't remember his name, but anyhow, he had a fish house. There was about four or five fish houses here then, and back in those days, of course, shrimp was plentiful, and they put you on a limit. You could only catch so many a day because they couldn't handle them. Put you on a limit, and if you caught over that limit, you had to shovel them overboard after they weighed in what they had told you to catch. You shoveled them overboard. There's been millions, literally millions of bushels of shrimp dumped overboard. My father, when he was in the fish business, he had three small boats. He put them on a 15-bushel limit. They go out and maybe catch 25 or 30 bushels. They come into the dock, unload the 15 bushels that was their quota for the day, shovel the rest of them overboard. I mean, that's the way it was. That was before World War II, you know.
Yeah.
And like I say, I what you owe the large market today for seafood is the fact of World War II and the men learned mm-hmm. what seafood was, what fresh fish was.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them didn't even eat fish, or they didn't know about shrimp even.
Yeah. Well, just to look at a shrimp, if you've never seen one before, it's kind of a peculiar looking
right,
picture, you know?
Right. That's right.
Now, did these fish companies all own vessels?
They all own vessels.
Mm-hmm. What kind of financial arrangements would they have with the skippers and crews?
You paid a percentage of the catch.
Mm-hmm.
The way that most boats work today is fairly similar to the way they've always worked. Today, most of your boats pay 35% of the catch. They come in and say, we've got $100 worth of shrimp. We'll use that
right.
as a figure.
Sure.
The crew gets 35 cents, $35 out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But they've got to pay their own grocery bill and their own ice bill. The company that owns the boat, they pay the fuel bill
mm-hmm.
and the net bills. And they actually work on those lines, same lines as they did. Some of the boats back in the older days worked on thirds. The boat took a third, the crew took a third, and the rigging took a third.
What would the rigging be? I don't understand
your
that.
Your nets, your engine overhauls, and all that.
Hmm.
And the fuel.
So who would keep that third? Would you keep
the
it?
The owner of the boat.
Yeah.
The owner of the boat.
Hmm. Now, did you fish that way?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Did you ever own your own boat?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Three different times.
Mm-hmm. Now, who did you first work for here in Mayport?
First man I ever sold to was Anton Johnson. And he was the light tender, the buoy tender that took care of all the lights here in the river. And he had a contract with the government to do that. And he also had a little fish house. He started a little fish house there. He was a cranky old cuss, though. He was really cranky. I later went down after fishing for him for about 4 months, and I couldn't get along with him. He had a very beautiful wife and a very lovely woman. You could get along with her fine, but you couldn't get along with Anton.
Mm-hmm.
Then I later went down to Ike Lewis, who was a black man. And I never had a better relationship with anybody in my life than I did with Ike Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
His son-in-law, Roy Ruffin, ran the fish house for him. And he was a good man to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody in Mayport just had as much respect for those two people as they did any white person in Mayport.
Yeah. Were they the only blacks who ever had?
They were the only blacks that ever had a fish house here.
Mm-hmm. Before we started taping here today, I mentioned that I was over at Mr. Rowland's, and he was telling me about sort of the atmosphere in the picking area and the fact that people used to sing. Can you describe that? Because he didn't have a very good memory about that. What was it like?
Well, if I follow you on what was it like, was the fact that it was just the black, back in those days, it was just the blacks in Mayport that hid his shrimp. And we had quite a large black community back in those days, where we only probably got 18 or 20 black families today. We had a couple of hundred black families back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all fairly well religious. And they'd get down there, it would help them. I guess it would help them in their work, keep them perked up and everything else. Somebody would break out with a song, and everybody would join in. It wasn't boisterous, loud, or anything like that. It was low and within means to where it didn't disturb anybody trying to talk in the building.
Mm-hmm.
But they continuously sang, or if they got tired of singing, they'd hum. And I tell you, it was a pleasure to walk down there in the fish house and listen to them.
Yeah.
It really was.
Could this be going on at any time?
Occasionally it happens now, but it's very rare, very rare. They've gotten to the point to where they use too much foul language, and that just breaks the spirit of the older blacks, the younger blacks. The language that they use, it's just broken the spirit of the older blacks that would still sing if it wasn't for interference.
Hmm. How many of the fish businesses here in Mayport now have heading areas like Matt Rowland has?
They all do. The only, well, is Al Leek here, which is Atlantic Seafood, Matt Rowland, the Miss Becky Seafood, and that's it. Well, we used to have five or six fish houses.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, we had more shrimp in those days, more fish in those days. Trout fishermen, we had a lot of trout fishermen back in those days. Cane pole fishermen, they catch 100, 200, 300 pounds of trout a day. They go and cast net for their live shrimp, take the shrimp along, get the shrimp before the tide was right to trout fish, and they'd go and trout fish with a pole. And some of them would get as much as 300 pounds a day with a cane pole.
Where would they fish?
Different places, back here in Dark Entry, over in Fort George River, Nassau, different places.
Yeah.
At different times of year meant where the fish were going to be.
Mm-hmm. I notice, I see people with rods and reels up around here, but I notice people with nets and other types of gear that they're using off the bridges and on the beaches. What do you call some of the stuff that they use?
Well, mostly, you mean, for instance, this bridge out here you're talking about?
Yeah.
Well, they're using regular rods and reels, and a lot of them do a lot of crabbing. There's a lot of crabs in that creek out there, and they do a lot of crabbing with nets. They'll go to the market and buy some chicken necks, tie them in the bottom of that net, lower the net down, leave it down half 10, 15 minutes, and they pull it up real fast. Crabs will be on that chicken in there, and they catch crabs that way. But they do catch a lot of trout and red bass out at that little bridge out there. It's very good fishing at times.
Are there any types of nets that people throw or use on the beach?
Oh, cast nets.
Yeah.
Cast nets. And a lot of people have wade seines, what we call a wade seine. It's around 200, 225 feet long. And one person takes the net, we'll say the beach is here. All right, he enters the water here, and the current, you've got a predominantly northerly current here. He goes out on an angle like this, so he gets out beyond the slough. You always haul where there's a slough just outside of the beach.
What's a slough?
Slough, that's a hollowed out place in the beach.
Mm-hmm.
The fish lay in that slough because as the waves come in, it brings food, shellfish, small bait fish, and things like that into the slough. That's where your fish congregate. And they'll go out till they get almost to the end of that slough, and then they will come ashore and drag that slough out with that net.
One person alone does that?
No. It takes at least two. Mm-hmm. At least two. One on the offshore, what we call the offshore staff man. He's the one that goes out and makes a circle in the ocean itself. Another man on the shore holding the other end of the net. And as he starts ashore, then the man on shore, he starts to move to where the other man is going to come ashore. So when they do get ashore, they're not over 10 or 12 feet apart, so they have the fish in a small area of the net.
Oh, yeah. Now, it's the man... offshore staff man, that's what you call
yeah.
him. Is the man ashore? Does he have a job that has a name too?
Not really.
Yeah.
Not really. He's usually the owner of the rig.
<I see. Okay.
laughs> I fished with a man, he's dead and gone many years ago. The name of Tony Near. We all call him Uncle Tony. Now he would wear a pair, he wore Florsheim shoes all the time. And he would go down there with a high gloss shine on those things, and you was waiting for him. You was a staff man for him. And he'd never get his shoes wet. And he'd kill you, man. I'm telling you. You out there pulling him, see, pulling against him all the time. He's not getting down to the water and helping you and moving towards you. You've got to move back towards him. He's not going to get his shoes wet.
I've heard stories about him, I guess. And,
yeah, he's quite a character.
He used to build model boats, too, someone told me.
No, not him.
No, maybe I'm thinking of someone else.
Singleton is the only one that I know. Captain Tarble, he built model schooners.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he built model schooners back in his day.
Mm-hmm.
After he retired from bar pilot, he built model schooners.
Mm-hmm. How long has there been Pilots Association here in Mayport?
I guess for 75, 80 years at least, or maybe longer. Maybe go back to 100 years.
And before that, what did they? What was there any kind of a organization, or how did they bring in the vessels at that time?
No, you got in the best way. The master of the vessel got in the best way he could.
Yeah. Well, how'd you get into party boating?
Well, when I, in 1933, I was going with a lady that owned a boat. She just had a new boat built. It was a 33-foot boat. So I had a lot of friends in Jacksonville that fished. So I started running an open boat. I only carried 10 passengers on a 33-foot boat. I carried 10 passengers. Mostly I tried to get charters. Only charged them $25 a day. That was me, another man, ice, bait, and tackle. Charged them $25 a day. And then later on, it got in the summertime where you couldn't get too many charters. Well, you'd run open parties. You'd carry 10 people for $2.50 apiece.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I got started in it. Mm-hmm. Then later on, which is about 20 years ago, after I had retired, in fact, I got a very good friend in Jacksonville that deals in boats. He buys, rebuilds, and sells boats. He and I got together. He owned a party boat, a 65-foot party boat. So he was having trouble. He had always somebody else running the boat. You know, he didn't run it. And he was having trouble always getting all the money that was for the passengers that went on the boat. So he made me manager of the boat. And I managed the boats. In fact, I started running the concession on the boat. I saw where I could pick myself up $100 a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I just opened a concession on that. Sold mm-hmm. sandwiches, beer, and cold drink.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started handling his boats after we sold the party boat. Sold it to Gary Weaver that formerly owned Monty's Marina down there.
Oh, yeah.
The name Monty's Marina came from a man that originally built the marina. His name was Montgomery, down at the beach. In fact, he was mayor of Jacksonville Beach at one time. He owned a lumber business in Neptune Beach. And that's how it got its name, Monty's Marina, and they have never changed it from that day to this. But I later on got what Hagen made me a good proposition I couldn't turn down. It was not anything strenuous, and it was just to promote and sell the boats that he would buy and rebuild. So I'd advertise a little bit in the paper, in different boating magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And back in those days, this was, say, 10, 11 years ago, I started with him in the selling boats. We were selling to men that was going to haul pot with them. They didn't tell us they were going to haul pot with them.
Yeah.
But when a man comes and sits down on your couch and throws a briefcase up there with $10,100 bills in there, you know that the man's got a whole pot with a boat, which we didn't care.
Yeah.
No, we didn't care. We didn't sign any papers over to him at all. If the boat got caught, of course they'd go through customs and trace the boat back to you.
Yeah.
The boat was stolen.
Mm-hmm.
We hadn't reported it stolen. He'd get caught within 3 or 4 days, or he'd get away with it forever, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
He'd make 4 or 5 successful trips. He'd sink the boat. The boat got too well known.
Mm-hmm.
So they started watching this particular guy. So what does he do? Two boats goes offshore, one comes back. They sink the other one.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. I had a man sit right on that couch right there. Throw a briefcase up. In fact, three different times it happened. I sold him one boat for $55,000, one for $65,000, and one for $135,000. Sat right there on that couch and didn't open the briefcase. He laid it up there and says, "Count it up." And that's all it was to it.
Hmm.
He either took the boat and left here with it, or he sent a crew down here to take the boat away. And that was it. There was no papers signed, no papers made, nothing.
Do you see a lot of parallels between the old bootlegging days and the dope smuggling days of today?
Yes, there is. Mm-hmm. whiskey I know is bad, and if the person uses it, abuses the use of it. But I still can't see where whiskey does near as much harm to young people as this dope, and especially this crack. I've never even seen it. I've seen it on television,
yeah.
Heard about it, but that's ruining the minds of our future generations. Mm-hmm. We're going to come up here with a bunch of idiots trying to run this country in the next 20 years.
Yeah.
That's exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I hate to see it.
Yeah.
Maybe I won't live to see it. I'm shooting for 100 anyhow. I'll be 82 the 26th of this month. So I'm shooting for 100.
Good enough.
I believe I'm going to make it, too.
All right.
I really do.
What did you need to know to be a good party boat skipper?
Know the bottom out there where you're snapper fishing. And you learn that through commercial fishing with somebody else, commercial snapper fishing with somebody else.
How far out would you go?
Well, with a party boat, you rarely go over 20 miles. And in fact, you're not supposed to go more than 20 miles. That's the way your license reads.
Oh, yeah.
It's 20 miles. We did go 30 and 35 miles.
Mm-hmm.
But it was rare occasions that we did that. Like go out to East 18. East 18 is 28 miles. We weren't supposed to go that far, but we did.
Mm-hmm.
The Coast Guard didn't say anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, back in those days, the Coast Guard would rarely venture out that far themselves unless it was an emergency.
What was it like dealing with your customers?
I never had any trouble, really, with customers. I've had a lot of trouble on the boats, among people on the boats. But if I saw it coming, I'd go back there and try to talk to them. Buy them a beer.
Yeah.
Sit down and talk to them.
Yeah.
Try to talk them out of it.
Like what? You mean like people would have an argument?
That's right. That's right. They'd want to fight. It was getting ready to fight.
Yeah.
So go back and talk to them. Start a conversation. Butt in, make a conversation. Start talking about fishing. Or when you're coming back again. Or where do you live? How long have you been here? How long are you going to stay? Talk to them. Buy them a beer. And you kept from having a mess up on your boat. Maybe somebody getting hurt seriously where you had to come in and lose a day.
Yeah.
I tell you, if you don't have a good public relation man on a party boat, it can hurt you and hurt you bad.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important person in that role is the captain of the boat. The captain and the mates. There's 2 to 3 mates on each boat. Unless they're jovial sort of people, it makes for a dull day of fishing, and most of those people aren't coming back unless the crew is courteous to them.
Yeah. One thing that I hear a lot of people talk about that have never been offshore fishing is, well, how rough is it going to be? Am I going to get sick? How close attention would you pay to the weather and that sort of thing?
Very close attention. Very close attention. Because this fact, you so tickets to 50 people this morning to take them fishing. If you had a bad barometer reading or you had a weather forecast that said it was going to blow from a certain direction that would harm you and you couldn't fish in close and catch a few fish, you didn't go. Because if you went out there, made your run out there, you had your bait all cut when you got there, rods and reels all out, everything was ready to fish when you got there. All right, you go out. Then this weather comes up 15 minutes, 30 minutes, or an hour after you get out of there. Get out there. You've got to turn around and bring those people back to the dock and refund their money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cost you just as much
mm-hmm.
as if you had stayed out there 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to be smart and watch the weather.
Yeah.
And not take people out there when they are going to get seasick.
Mm-hmm.
Now, well, some people are going to get seasick regardless.
Are there any remedies or cures that people had for seasickness?
Not. 90% of it's in the mind. 90% of it's in the mind. We know that equilibrium, your inner ear, does affects you in motion sickness. But they have all kinds of pills you can take for it. Some of them work with some people. But if a person goes out there with their in their mind, I'm going to get seasick, I'll guarantee you he or she is going to get seasick.
Yeah.
You better believe that. You go out there telling yourself you're going out for a day's pleasure, you're going to enjoy it, and you're going to catch a big fish, and don't think about that seasickness, then nobody's going to get seasick. But if some person does get seasick, and one of the mates doesn't get to him in time and get him back in a corner or inside of the head, inside to where they can use the head, and they're fishing, you got 20 people strong.
This is the start of side two of tape two of the interview with Albert Gufford.
We used to have a bunch of beer gardens around here, beer taverns.
Oh, yeah.
And although there's various names to them, one of them was a bucket of blood, and the other one was a bucket of guts. like out where the naval station then was called East Mayport, and we had a section called Wonderwood. And Pogieville was down where the Pogie plant was. The different points in the river have different names, various names. But other than that, it was just pretty well Mayport.
Yeah. What about where your house is right now? Is this any particular?
This was sand dunes.
Sand dunes?
This was sand dunes. In fact, when I moved here almost 22 years ago, there was one little building sitting right next door to me here that had about two rooms in it. They eventually tore it down. But all of this in here was high sand dunes.
Huh.
Every bit of it was high sand dunes. All of this over here was all sand dunes.
Mm-hmm.
And back before World War II, and at the beginning of World War II, you had people were built in those hollows of the sand dunes.
Yeah.
And if you had a good strong northeaster for 4 or 5 days while you was walking on an inch of sand or 2 inches of sand inside of the house, I don't care how tightly you had it closed, the sand would get in there.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely will.
Hmm. So I guess they just leveled everything out to
That's
make
right.
what's
mm-hmm.
there now?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, property became more valuable, you know, and there was less property while people started. We have a lot of retired people here, Navy retired people.
Mm-hmm.
This man that lives across the street here from me, he bought that place a year and a half ago, I guess. Bought it from people by the name of Toppins. They had lived there for about 5 years. She owned a couple of school buses, and he owned a fishing boat. And he wasn't a very good fisherman. Later on, he got out of the fishing business. And he went to work for B.B. McCormick and Sons down at Jacksonville Beach. In fact, he's a purchasing agent down there now. He sold this property over here when he moved to these Navy people, and he's just about ready to retire now. And he paid an exorbitant price for the property because it was the only piece of property left in Mayport that you could put a trailer on. If you have a piece of property with a trailer on it and you move off of it, if you put a trailer back on it within 12 months, it's legal to have the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
If you wait 12 months and one day, you can't put anything but a house back there.
Uh-huh.
And you got to have so many square feet of property before you can put a house on there. And then limit the size of the house according to the limit of the size of the property.
Uh-huh. Yeah. How many people live in town now?
In Mayport now?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll say maybe 200.
Mm-hmm. 200. Was there more than that when you first came?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Because there was houses everywhere, all over the streets. Down these streets here, we call that section back there, we call that the hill.
The hill.
That's where the blacks lived.
Yeah.
And if you refer, you was going to talk about something back there, you said, well, the hill. referred to all the time. It's the hill. Mm-hmm. But I can say one thing, that we have a, with the blacks, we don't have any trouble with them here. Some of these younger ones occasionally try to get, well, they get on dope, and they try to get a little smart with you. You just don't pay any attention to them. Ignore them. It'll go away. Mm-hmm. But as far as the older blacks, like Eddie Baker, older blacks, we don't have any trouble at all. Never have had. Mm-hmm. Never have had. Mm-hmm. We've had occasionally back there 40, 50 years ago, we'd have some black would come from up north somewhere, and he was probably on the lam from some robbery or killing or something else, and he'd come into Mayport. Well, he thought he was good as Christ himself. He'd come in here and start pushing the white people around. Uh-huh. And believe me, the blacks would take it up as quick as the white man would. If he started picking on the white man, the blacks would take it up as quick as the white man. And they'd just run him out. Hmm. If it took baseball bats to get him out, they'd put him out with a baseball bat. Took pitchforks, they used pitchforks. They weren't easy on him. No, that's a lively little town. It really was. You could go out and have a good time, or you could go out and have you two or three fights a night. It uh-huh. didn't make any difference. However you wanted to enjoy yourself that night, you could get it. So somebody was waiting. There was always somebody ready to fight.
How come the population has declined so much over the years?
The Navy has taken... We've got no place to put houses anymore.
Yeah.
No place to put houses.
What did people think when they started putting up the base over there?
Well, they didn't like it, of course. But what can you do against the government? Yeah. They condemn your property and take it.
Yeah.
Now, you can take them to court if the property is really worth more than they're willing to pay, you can take them to court and win a suit.
Yeah.
But back in those days, you couldn't. If they said, I'm going to give you $25 for this property and it's worth $2,500, you got $25 for it. You had no recourse.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not. But it's a different thing today.
Yeah.
Thank God.
We're talking about black folks in Mayport a moment ago. Were there many men like Captain Eddie who were black skippers here?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We had quite a number of them. Manuel Jesus, that owned this fish house right exactly where Al Leek's fish house
yeah.
is now. 99% of his crews were always blacks. He got along good with them. He paid them what he wanted to pay them. He weighed his shrimp in on platform scales, Mm-hmm. Each one of they brought them up in fish baskets, put them on the scales. The fish basket, then you knew what the fish basket weighed. That's what you deducted. But he could, with the blacks, he could push the blacks around. Instead of taking 27 pounds off with a basket, he'd probably take 80 pounds off. Hmm. The black man couldn't say anything. If he did, he got fired. And there was another black standing out there waiting on his job.
Mm-hmm.
It did. The old man Roland, he never did that. The only one I ever knew to do that was... Manuel Jesus and Booty Singleton that owned the Singleton Seafood Company. He's dead and gone now. But he used to do that, and the fishermen finally caught up with him on that. So they was going to have an inspector come down and check his platform scales. And he had those things set to where they would steal 80 pounds from you regardless. And they all went down there in a bunch one day. And he didn't do a damn thing but take the scales and roll them off at the end of the dock in the water to keep them from checking the scales.
Hmm.
And anybody in Mayport will tell you that actually happened.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like the people who have run the fish companies have been pretty powerful individuals.
They have. Mm-hmm. Now, Matt, he doesn't own any boats anymore. He's finally gotten rid of all of his boats. He always had a headache with his boats. His crew stole shrimp from him. They tore engines up. And he used to Like I told you once before, I think he used to bring Portuguese over here. Every time there was a quota, he could bring two, three, or four. Well, he brought them over here. He put them on the boats, put them on that with an American captain until they got to know a little bit, but for a year or so. Mm-hmm. Then he would turn the boat over to them. But by the same token, they weren't American citizens yet. They had to have one American citizen on the boat. Well, he usually hired a black and paid him a very small amount. You had to have the captain, had to be a United States citizen, and his name had to be on the boat's papers.
Yeah.
Where today, they've eliminated that now. You don't have to be on the papers of the boat anymore. So the people that are not even American citizens operate boats now, and there's nothing said about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way they've, just the way they've changed the law.
Yeah. Were there, when do you think Mayport was first settled anyway?
Well, it was back in the 1700s. It was back in the 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was back in the 1700s. They used to bring slaves in to Mayport for different areas south of here that had no inlet. And they used to walk those slaves from here to St. Augustine on farther south. And they had a road that went out of Mayport. And if you know where Uncle John's tavern is out there at the overpass.
Yeah, yeah.
That road that leads right down side of him, he sits like this, and the road goes right back of him like this, was known as the Turnbull Trail. And a man by the name of Turnbull was a slaver. And he used to come in with his schooner loaded with slaves and drive them down there.
Hmm.
Walk them down there, and that was known as Turnbull Trail.
Many years later, when this started opening up as a shrimping area, were there people from other countries who came here as fishermen?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Norwegians, Swedes, Portuguese, Italians.
Did they settle here?
No, they never put roots down here. They never put roots down here. They, we don't have a Portuguese family that lives in Mayport at all. They all live out in Ocava. Mm-hmm. All got nice homes out there. But they never seemed to put down root. Now, Mr. Rowland, old man Rowland, Matt's daddy, lived in Mayport for years. They had a nice two-story home up there, and they lived here for years. But we've ever had over five or six families of Portuguese that ever lived for more than 3 or 4 months in Mayport.
Mm-hmm. What kind of occupations have people followed apart from fishing? People who have lived here?
Well, some of the kings that owned the old haunted house up here, you know. Now, their father was a bar pilot. The original old Captain King was a bar pilot. None of the boys ever followed in his footsteps. They all went into some other thing in Jacksonville. We used to have a train that run in here, left in the morning, came back in the afternoon. They rode the train to work. That was before the days of very many automobiles. And they would go into sales, mostly sales, ship's hardware, machinery, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't very many people that were original Mayports that didn't follow in their forefathers' footsteps and become fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
Most all of them did.
Yeah.
But most of those people have migrated away from here now over in the Gulf Coast.
Oh, yeah.
The Gulf Coast of Florida, Louisiana, Texas.
Why have they moved over that way?
Shrimping was better over there.
Mm-hmm.
Shrimping was much better over there. They've got far more area to fish than we have. Where we fish, not more than 8, 9, 10 miles offshore here, they fish 70, 80, 90 miles offshore. I mean, the water that shallow, the Gulf, is a shallow body of water. Of course, it's deep in places. But you can go, now for instance, Morgan City, I shrimp fished out of Morgan City well, about a year and a half. And we had to run, well, by the time we got to the Gulf, we had to run at least 5 hours before you ever got in the fishing ground, deep enough water to fish in.
Hmm.
It's shallow.
Yeah.
And can become rough in a hurry. Especially if a nor'wester hits you. Nor'wester hits you, that shallow water can get, a lot of times you've got to go to anchor. Stay in deep water and go to anchor because you, there's no vessel in the world with the shallow water. The seas would be so big in there, you'd ride up on the sea, and you come down in the trough of it and hit bottom.
Mm-hmm. Not too good for the bottom.
You better believe it's not.
You mentioned the King House a moment ago, and we chatted about this the other morning, and other people have talked to me about it in different ways. And some people say it's haunted, and other people say it's not. What's your opinion on that, anyway?
It's definitely not haunted.
Definitely. What's the significance of that place?
John King, the survivor of the King family, the male, he lived in that house up until he died after his sisters married and moved away. He was finally became the owner of the house. It went down through channels, and he was the last male heir, so they all deeded it to him, quit claim deeds, and he owned it. Whenever he retired from work, he was a lonely man. He didn't mingle very well. So he liked children. He did. He liked young people. And he loved beer. Well, he put the word out here, two or three of these kids around Mayport, that the house was haunted. They were all going to the school at the beach, and it became publicly known there was a haunted house in Mayport. He did not charge admission. But he had a box there. You could drop 50 cents, a quarter, a dollar, whatever you wanted to. And that's how it became a haunted house. Now, he had a lot of thought of things rigged up there where he could make some terrible noises. But as far as being haunted, because I know several people have lived there. In fact, I lived there one time. It was not haunted. No way it was haunted. It was an attraction.
Yeah.
An attraction.
The first time that I came to see you, you were telling me about your brother and his occupation as Justice of the Peace. Can you tell me a little bit about him and how long he did that?
Well, he was, I imagine he was Justice of the Peace about 12 years. Judge Gavigan was our first Justice of the Peace. Then after that, after Judge Gavigan died, Harley Giddens, whom was a co-owner of Giddens Griffith Funeral Home, which is Giddens Funeral Home now. Hardage Giddens it is now. They appointed him Justice of the Peace. Well, he was an alcoholic. So he'd hold court in his swim shorts with a bottle sitting on the floor, and he'd take a shot every time. He took a notion to take a shot, he'd take a shot. Well, he abused it so much, and the governor was getting so many complaints on it until he impeached him. He fired him and appointed my brother. And my brother was Justice of the Peace up until the time he died.
What was your brother's first name?
Bill. Mm-hmm. William S. Gufford, Sr. Mm-hmm. William S. Gufford, Sr. He was a fair man. I'll say that for him. In fact, I got in a fight right in front of my house here about 20 years ago, and I had to go before him, and believe it or not, he fined me $75.
That's fair.
He did not show partiality. No, he did not show partiality.
Well, what kind of power did a Justice of the Peace have then?
Any warrant that was issued or any person that had committed a crime or anything else, the warrant had to be taken in this district if it was committed in this district. He tried the person. He found them not guilty or bound them over to criminal court. Mm-hmm. And he could bind them over to criminal court with the understanding that if the man is convicted, he's given 15 years. 6 years, he can be paroled. He held jurisdiction over that man for that 15 years. He decided whether that man should be paroled or not. Mm-hmm. He did on all of his cases. He says, in order to be fair to whomever he may have committed the crime against, which was his family or a friend or whoever, he wanted to know whether the man was ready to come back in society or not. Mm-hmm. And he judged him that way.
Mm-hmm. Did he hold trials or anything
like that? Oh, yeah.
Would that be here in Mayport?
No, he was at Jacksonville Beach.
Oh, yeah.
He lived in Jacksonville Beach. He'd been a city councilman for quite a number of years down there. In fact, he was a city councilman when he was appointed. Mm-hmm. His trade was boilermaking.
Oh, yeah.
He was a boilermaker. He built the Southside Generating Plant. He built the boilers in that. The East Jacksonville Plant, he built the boilers in that. He built boilers for in Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, West Florida, all over. He was always busy until he got to where he was just tired of it.
Yeah.
And he retired from that and didn't do anything for about 4 or 5 years, except city council. He was elected to city council. He quit the city council 2 or 3 different times and went back to boiler making because it'd be so damn much controversy among the old timers down there, the old clique, that he would just get disgusted with it. Mm-hmm. He'd quit the city council and go back to boiler making until he was appointed by the governor as justice of the peace, and he stayed in politics until he died.
Mm-hmm. How have people in Jacksonville and the other communities near here regarded Mayport and the people who live here over the years?
Well, I don't think that they had too high regards for the people in Mayport. We were just a little community down here, and we were more or less outcast. But yet, a lot of people thought the world of us. But most people would look down their nose at you.
Mm-hmm.
Which it didn't bother us at all.
Yeah. Because what, they thought you were poor, uneducated fishermen? That
right,
sort of thing?
Right. That's right, exactly.
What have you liked about living in Mayport?
I love the water. I know everybody in Mayport on a first-name basis. I can go anywhere to any house, any fish dock down here, stay as long as I want to, talk to whoever I want to, go on the boats, talk to the captains on the boat. If I want some shrimp, I go down, the boat's unloading, they'll ask me, every one of them will ask me, Mr. Guffey, do you want some shrimp? I say yes, they'll give me shrimp. I got a freezer full of shrimp out there right now. Want fish, I get fish. I know everybody. A lot of the men that's running boats here now had fished with me when they were kids.
Oh, yeah.
And they respect their elders. They really do. I can say that for the Mayport people. They do respect their elders. They're just a darn good bunch of people.
Yeah.
There's no getting around it. Yeah. I always said, told my wife, when we first married, which was 41 years ago now, that when I retired, I was going to move back to Mayport. I was going to spend the remainder of my days back in Mayport. And after I got out of that marine business that I was in that deal with Martin G. Williams,
right,
I had to retire. My health was so bad, I didn't think I'd live another 2 years, and the doctors didn't either. Although I came out of it, and that's been 23 years ago, and I'm still alive and still doing darn good.
Mm-hmm.
And really enjoying life. My wife, of course, died next month, will be 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm. How many children did you have?
I had never had any by this, my last wife. We had one, and she had a miscarriage. She was about a little better than 7 months. And she had the miscarriage due to the fact that her doctor, Dr. Roberts, was taking care of her through her pregnancy. And Dr. Cohn, there was only the two doctors on the beaches then. Dr. Cohn was the other doctor. So she got some abdominal pains there one night. Dr. Roberts was out of town on a drunk. So I took her to Dr. Cone. And Dr. Cone, he was the type of doctor, when you walked in his office, he gave you a shot and he said, "Now what's wrong with you?" He gave her a shot, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, I had her in St. Luke's Hospital in Jacksonville, and at 5 o'clock the next morning, she miscarried. And the child lived 7 hours and died. He's really responsible for that. And after that, she had to have major female surgery, hysterectomy.
Yeah.
And we couldn't have any more children. But I have a daughter, 54 years old. I have a son that's 48 years old by previous marriages.
Yeah. Well, I think I've asked most of the questions I wanted to ask today.
Good.
We've been having a good conversation here.
Yeah.
Anything you wanted to add that I didn't ask you?
No, not really. I've enjoyed it, though. I really have.
I'm going to turn this off now.
All right.
This is the end of the second and final tape of the August 8, 1986 interview with retired fisherman and party boat captain Albert Gufford of Mayport, Florida. The interviewer was David Taylor, and the interview was done in connection with the Maritime Heritage Survey Project. End of interview, end of tape.